Hello and welcome to the Radioactive Ramblings podcast, a show where we're going to be covering Fallout on Amazon Prime. I'm one of your co-hosts, Aaron.
And I'm your other co-host, Chase. Today we are going to be covering episodes 1 through 3 of Fallout. We are going to start with a spoiler-free section and with our general thoughts and impressions of the season so far before we get into a scene-by-scene breakdown of the episode.
All right, let's get right into it. So, after watching episodes 1 through 3, I'm pretty excited about this show. I think it's turning out to be a pretty decent show. You know, I think that they've really nailed the Fallout vibe. I think that they got it down in a way that I wasn't expecting. I was half expecting to open up this show on Amazon Prime last night and have it be shit. I was really expecting that, to be honest.
I did have high hopes for the show, and I think so far they have delivered. A lot of the CGI looked great. I mean, there are a few things to nitpick about, but we'll talk about that later. But yeah, I think so far it is worth the time investment for sure.
Absolutely. And just from watching the first three episodes, I know that they released the first two to some people who got like early screeners. And it makes sense that they would release the first two to those folks who got the screeners, because it feels like those two are meant to be one continuous story. And then the third one is like you're really getting into the series. The first two episodes are very much the introduction. I think the actors are doing a really great job as well, if I'm being honest. There wasn't a single performance that I thought, wow, this fucking sucks. I watched all these characters really embody the factions, the different aspects of Fallout, and they're all really funny. You know, they have the comedy down. They've got the comedic timing down, which I wasn't expecting from the Westworld team, because if I remember correctly from the two episodes of Westworld that I've seen, it's not a funny show. It's very much just a serious drama. And that's going to wrap up our very brief spoiler-free section. If you haven't seen episodes 1 through 3 yet, now would be a good time to head out. Come back to us later once you've watched those episodes. Spoilers for these three episodes, as well as some spoilers for the Fallout games, will be fair game during the spoiler section. Or if you don't care about spoilers and you haven't seen the episodes yet, feel free to stick around. Let's get into episode 1. In pre-war America, an actor named Cooper Howard, accompanied by his daughter, performs as a cowboy for a children's birthday party. Cooper is asked to give his famous thumbs up, but he declines. When the bombs drop, Cooper and his daughter try to escape the blast on their horse. This is the opening to the show, right? And it really sets the vibe. They've got some people in the background, like, making jokes about this guy, Cooper Howard, doing a birthday party. He's supposed to be a pretty big deal, it sounds like, but we don't really know too much about him at the point of this first scene. And the fact that he seems to be a pretty famous guy and he's doing a children's birthday party raises a lot of questions, like how did he get to this point in his life? Why doesn't he want to do the little thumbs up? It had me laughing a little bit when the guy on the news was talking about how he didn't want to do the weather report because he didn't even know if there was going to be a tomorrow, and everyone just kind of turns off the TV and ignores it.
I think about the thumbs up thing, or not the thumbs up thing, about Cooper Howard. I think one of the moms mentioned something about alimony or something when they're like, why is he here doing a birthday party?
So after the title card that reads 219 years later, we open on Lucy McLean, a vault dweller of Vault 33. And it looks like this is sort of trying to emulate the games a little bit, where at the beginning you pick out all of your special skills. Any thoughts on that? You haven't played much Fallout besides Fallout Shelter, right?
Yeah, so you're not too familiar with that. That's actually one of the only things I do know about in Fallout, is that like at the beginning of the game you can like, it's like D&D with your stats where you get to choose your stat spread, and I know that you can like max out your luck stat and like have zero and everything else and stuff like that. Like, you have complete control over that. I think when we were watching the show, she kind of like lying about some of her stats, you know. She was like, I'm not that great at shooting the gun, and then it like cuts to her target and she like only hit the bullseye or something like that.
Yeah, she seems like she's got the skills to survive in the wasteland, even though her demeanor is very naive and sort of clueless about the workings of the outside world. She's definitely got the makings of a badass. It's not really come out yet, but she's got the base there for that.
I mean, yeah, later on this episode, when we see how the wedding turns out, right, we see that she does have skills.
Yeah, definitely. I think that she makes a comment here about the fact that there were no suitable marriage candidates for her in her own vault because most of the people in the vault are her cousins, which they bring up that joke a few more times in the episode.
Oh, yeah, right before she's supposed to meet who she's betrothed to, her cousin is like, I love you. She's like, it's okay to mess around with your cousin, but not for marriage, which was kind of crazy.
That was a crazy bar that she dropped. I guess when you're living in a confined space with only, I mean, how many people do we think live in this vault? A few dozen? A few hundred?
I mean, it's probably closer to like double digits or like low triple digits, right?
Yeah.
I mean, I'm assuming everyone was there for the wedding and like that didn't look like too many people and it was both vaults or the quote unquote vault 32 and vault 33.
Yeah. To move on to the wedding, we touched on that a little bit. We find out that the overseer of this vault is her father, and he's actually not from this vault. He's from Vault 31. We get a little bit of information about how these three vaults sort of work in tandem with one another, do some trading. They're all seeming to be connected via underground tunnels, which is something unique. We've never seen two vaults be connected in this way before in the lore, so I thought it was interesting that they decided to create three new vaults that were all connected to each other.
Yeah, I mean, one thing I don't get about the underground stuff is how are they growing corn? Like, how does that work? I saw that they were, like, eating meat from, it looked like spam for the wedding. And, like, I'm assuming that's from, like, a limited supply because are they raising livestock? How are they? I have a lot of questions on how they're sustaining themselves for 219 years post-nuclear fallout across the entire United States and probably beyond.
Yeah, so in a lot of vaults, they've got a fairly large crop field, whatever. They've got hydroponics on a few different levels in some vaults. Some of them have livestock. I think that to answer your question about how is this shit growing underground, I want to say they've got UV lamps in the farming areas. And to talk about the farming area real quick, they've got a projector set up to pretend like they're outside, which I thought was pretty funny.
Yeah. Supposedly it's showing them Nebraska.
I enjoyed the fact that they are just beaming in images on a loop of the Nebraska countryside. They're not trying to show the outside world in California like before the war. So they're just straight up transplanting these people to a place that they will never see and aren't even close to with those projections. I guess anything to keep yourself sane when you're living underground for your entire fucking life. I would go pretty crazy if I couldn't see the outside world.
I think the sanity thing is more about having people, though, for sure. I mean, I believe at least, because they have a lot of amenities down there, like games on their like wrist thing. They have a ton of stuff that I didn't expect to be down there.
All right, let's move on to the actual wedding celebrations. We see the quote-unquote vault dwellers of Vault 32. They are ravenous, man. They're chowing down on that food. They're taking food off of other people's plates. They seem like they haven't eaten in a while. That still tracks with the story that they've been peddling, that this is a situation in which they're starving. They've told the people of Vault 33 that their crops have failed. So that's the story that they've gone with. And then we've got her father, the overseer, delivering a speech about how their kids are going to be able to recolonize the wasteland safely.
You kind of see the building suspicion towards Vault 32's vault dwellers through her brother. They kind of cut to him and like show him observing weirder and weirder behaviors out of Vault 32. Also, going back to her father talking about how this marriage is offspring are going to be the generation of vault dwellers that repopulate the world. I think that's really interesting. And also kind of surprising. I didn't think it would take that long for like the nuclear fallout to settle. It's kind of surprising it's gonna take like probably what, like 230 240 years for the wasteland to become normal levels of radiation.
One of the main things to remember about all of these vaults is that they're all, or not all, but most of them are experiments, and a lot of them are being lied to. So the majority of the population on the surface are actually descendants of vaults that opened a lot sooner. They're not all just survivors of people who managed to hide away from the blasts. A lot of vaults opened way earlier, and some of them were never meant to open. And I think that whatever experiment is going on in this vault, they definitely lied to these people about how long it would take for there to be livable surface radiation. Because Vault-Tec, at the end of the day, are a bunch of fucking liars.
Yeah, I think we get a little of that when we meet the scientists and the way he talks about how the banana-flavored poison is, like, the one thing that they made that wasn't, like, super inhumane. Yeah, I didn't know that most of the people alive today in the Fallout universe are descendants of earlier vaults opening up.
Yeah, and they make a few comments during the wedding celebrations about not letting the wasteland change them when they leave the vault, which is unfortunately what happens with most people when they leave the vault. They go outside, they experience the harsh realities of this new world, and society kind of collapses. They don't exactly have their ideals left, or they don't really have the space to be idealistic when the world is trying to kill them constantly. You know, you gotta do what you gotta do to survive in the wasteland.
Yeah, it's hard when you have an axolotl the size of a bear trying to eat you.
Yeah, hard to stand on your morals when an irradiated bear is mauling you, huh? Next, we find out that the vault dwellers of Vault 32 are a bunch of damn fakers. They are raiders from the outside world, and they've come to destroy Vault 33 and take their resources. That's not before Lucy and her new husband have a passionate night together.
Night is a way to extrapolate that, I guess. It's more like fucking 5 minutes, I think.
Yeah, and then it looked like he went over to Lucy's curtains and rubbed his balls on the curtains.
Yeah, I was about to say, I think he rubbed, like, the cum off his dick on the damn curtains.
Yeah, that was a moment. That was when I was like, okay, this dude is definitely not from a vault. Because even if they'd been starving for a while and had a little bit less decorum than normal, a vault dweller would not be over there using the curtain.
I mean, she literally got up and, like, checked his radiation right after that while he was, like, drinking water out of a flower vase.
Yeah, she was like, there's something not right here with this dude. It was also a little bit suspicious that the moment they get into her room, the vault jumpsuit came off right away. That man did not spare any time. All right, let's talk for a second about the communal vault dress. That seems like, at that point, I feel like you just gotta wear the vault suit to your wedding, right? I don't know if you really want to be wearing the communal vault dress. It's not gonna fit everyone.
I think it's honestly, my disgust with it more comes with the fact that people are fucking in that shit and then you're wearing it too. If there was, like, etiquette to, like, take it off before pipe is laying, maybe it would be less weird and it's more of just, like, hey, this is the nicest thing we have to wear, and we're all gonna share it. Maybe Lucy's just the one that had to ruin it for everyone, though.
Maybe. But the woman who was talking to her before kind of sounded like, you know, she had a similar experience on her wedding night.
Yeah.
Once it's revealed that these Vault 32ers are a bunch of damn fakers, the vault just descends into chaos. The raiders take guns from the armory, they're shooting at people, they've got pipes and knives, and people are dying left and right. The vault dwellers are trying their best to put up a fight, but it seems like for the majority of the time that this conflict is going on, it definitely seems like the vault dwellers are on the losing side.
Yeah, what I kind of didn't understand, though, is why weren't they a little more cautious when opening up the door between the vaults? You know, like, obviously there's a security system set in place with the gatekeeper and such. I mean, I just feel like they have the telegram to communicate between with each other. Like, I feel like there should be, like, a code that they need or something before opening the gate. This is Vault Dweller and then, like, their fucking social security or some shit.
Yeah, knowing Vault-Tec, they probably do give these people social security numbers and shit, because their whole vision of rebuilding America, they've got the bureaucracy to go along with it, for sure. We find out that these Vault Dwellers who haven't been massacred have been taken and held for ransom over at the front, or not the front, I think it's the passageway between Vault 33 and Vault 32. But in any case, they're taken there and they're being held for ransom. The overseer comes and talks to the woman who was posing as the overseer, and she asks if he knows who she is, and it's revealed that this woman's name is Lee Moldaver. The overseer, in fact, does know of Lee Moldaver, which is suspicious. I don't know how he knows about the outside world. What does he know about this shit?
Well, I mean, clearly when she goes over to Lucy and says, "You look like your mother," I think that exposes the fact that either Lucy's mother was not a vault dweller, or her mother and her father went outside the vault previously, and that's why her mother passed away.
Yeah, that's a good point. The other theory I had about that was maybe the same thing happened to Vault 31, and that's why the father had to escape to Vault 32. Because we don't get any information about whether or not Vault 31 is still active.
Oh, I thought the overseers, besides like her father, the other overseers were like, we just talked to Vault 31.
You're right.
And they're fine.
No, you are absolutely correct. I forgot about that. So Vault 31 is okay. Maybe he's lying though about where he comes from. Maybe, or like you said, he could have just gone rogue for a little while, explored the wasteland. Yeah, I'm sure we're gonna find out more about that. If the overseer is still alive, we're gonna get a lot of info once Lucy decides to get her ass over to Moldaver and get her dad back. Moving on to our introduction to a Brotherhood of Steel aspirant named Maximus. He's getting the shit beat out of him by his fellow recruits, and we see a little flashback of him being saved by a Brotherhood Knight as a kid. At first, when I saw him getting the shit beat out of him, I thought maybe he's just unpopular, maybe it's hazing. I don't know. It was a little murky to me as to what was going on with that.
Yeah, when I saw him getting the shit beat out of him, and then, but like, I also saw like what they were wearing, and I was like, this looks very reminiscent of like US military. And I was like, maybe this guy did something to like give the class push-ups or some shit like that to piss everyone off. I'm not saying it was deserved.
Yeah, very well could have been, which I think we get a little bit of info about that in episode 3, and it seems like it was more hazing related. Even though it seems like they were hazing him for a good long while, like this shit seems to have been going on for months. Like, he's getting the brunt of this abuse for a long time.
Yeah.
And we see a Brotherhood of Steel airship and a squadron of vertibirds arrive on the landing strip, and we see for the first time some Brotherhood knights clad in their T-60 power armor. This was pretty fucking sick to see the airship blow in and see the helicopters and the power armor.
Yeah, I mean, I think the CGI there with like the giant blimp looking airship thing was really good actually, and I think the vertibirds actually look really, really cool.
Yeah, for sure. And I'm not sure what kind of direction they're going with the Brotherhood here. It seems like they're trying to make all Brotherhood chapters interconnected in this time period. Because in the past few games, they've very much been, if you're at the Brotherhood of Steel on the West Coast or the Brotherhood of Steel on the East Coast, they're two completely different organizations that are pretty much severed from each other. But they say something a little bit later in the episode that points to a possible reunification of the chapters into one cohesive Brotherhood of Steel. Which would be pretty, that would be a force to be reckoned with in the Wasteland with all these chapters together. And you know, you see the airships. The Brotherhood of Steel on the East Coast has an airship, so this could be the Pridwin from Fallout 4. We're not exactly sure. They could just have more airships. So all these knights are here for a reason. They are going to be given squires from the aspirants that are in the boot camp here. Some of these select few recruits are going to be put onto a little team, and it's gonna kickstart their career into the Brotherhood of Steel, possibly getting their own power armor and shit.
Yeah, I mean, we see that Maximus is on his hands and knees praying to become a squire.
Yeah, he definitely seems like he's ambitious. He's ready to move on to the next stage of his time in the Brotherhood of Steel. And spoiler alert, that does not happen. He does not get chosen, and he has a little tantrum.
When he started tweaking out, I literally was like dying, because the way he threw the tantrum was so funny, because he broke the toilet seat, started like flipping the other side of it up and down.
Yeah, he really took his anger out on the latrine. Bro was supposed to be cleaning it.
Yeah, I wonder if that whole thing was scripted or if he improvised the flipping of the up and down of the toilet seat.
Yeah, I wonder how much room they gave the actors to improvise, because they all seem to have a really good handle on how their characters are supposed to be acting in this world and in the context of their situations. So I hope that some of the stuff is ad-libbed, because it would be really funny. He seems to have that whole vibe of being, honestly, he seems kind of entitled, you know?
Yeah, I was gonna say, right here is where I feel like the downfall of his character started for me so far, which is crazy because he was like just introduced. But like, like, because since his introduction was, like, him getting beat up for what we see as no reason, I was, like, I gave him a pretty high bar, you know? I was, like, this guy's gonna be one of the good guys that, through hardship, comes out with a heart of gold. And then his best friend gets selected for being a squire, and he starts tweaking out on a toilet, and I was like, dude, come on.
Speaking about his friend who gets selected to be a squire, the friend wakes up. I think the character's name is Dane. Dane wakes up, puts on their boots. There are razor blades in the boot. Now Dane can't be a squire. Immediately, a hood gets put over Maximus's head, and he gets dragged away. I gotta be honest, I think he did it. I think he put those razor...
I do too, dude. Because when they asked him if he did it, and he, like, paused, and he was like, no, but I'm glad that it happened, I was like, nah, bro fucking did it. Bro fucking did it.
Yeah, without a doubt in my mind, I think he did it. I don't know if they're ever gonna say for sure whether or not he put the razor blades in there, but it really, everything is pointing to that. And we know he's petty enough to do it at this point. Only knowing him for what, like 10 minutes? We know he's pretty petty.
Yeah, also, like, the fact that he said he's glad it happened is, like, enough for me to be like, yeah, he would have done it. Like, even though, like, if it comes out that he didn't do it, the fact that he let that bar slip already makes me, like, not like him as a character.
The cleric in charge questions him, asks him if he did it. He denies it. It kind of seems like they're going to be putting him to death. And then at the last second, he decides to say exactly what this dude wants to hear and be like, I'll gladly give my life for the Brotherhood. Just complete, got Brotherhood propaganda spewing out of his gullet.
To be fair, though, he was indoctrinated by being rescued by a knight as a child, growing up idolizing that, being taken into the Brotherhood because he had nowhere else to go. I mean, it does make sense for his character to be that way. It's just he's kind of a shitty person on top of that.
So the cleric in charge here then assigns him to the knight that his friend Dane was supposed to be assigned to, Knight Titus, who just seems like a real stand-up guy. We'll get into that later, but yeah, seems like a real Brotherhood enthusiast here. Now, the final piece of info that is revealed by this cleric to newly squired Titus is that there's a remnant of an organization called the Enclave, and that's their mission, is to try and destroy that. He says that they've gotten reports from the Commonwealth clerics, the highest clerics in the Commonwealth, that there's an Enclave remnant out there. We're about to get into game spoilers, so if you haven't played the Fallout games, it's honestly kind of minor spoilers, just stuff about the factions in the universe. But if you are not inclined to hear anything about that, tune out now for just a little bit. Chase, what do you know about the Enclave?
Nada. Zero.
All right, that puts us in a good spot here for me to yap at you about the Enclave. Now, the Enclave is the remnants of the United States government and military, mostly military. These guys are straight up evil. They are the ones who are, like, creating super mutants in labs. They're doing fucked up experiments. They are killing wastelanders. Their whole doctrine is pretty much kill everyone in the outside world because we need to destroy everyone who's had genetic mutation or corruption or even a little bit of exposure to radiation. They just want to kill everything and start over again.
Epic.
Yeah, a real great group of people, right?
Now,
yep. Continued game spoilers. The Enclave are supposed to be gone. On the West Coast, the Brotherhood of Steel and the New California Republic stormed into their bunker, raided their oil rig. These guys are supposed to be gone. So the fact that there's a remnant out here, it's a little suspicious. I don't know how they got here. I don't know if they've been here the whole time or if this is like some other faction of the Enclave that's decided to post up here. But this group and the Enclave that are on the East Coast, they were in DC and they were destroyed by the Brotherhood there as well. So it'll be interesting to see how they survived all that. Let's move on to Lucy escaping the vault with the help of her brother Norman and her cousin. That seems like Norm kind of dropped the ball on this. He was supposed to hold the elevator. Bro had one job and he didn't do it.
Well, clearly he hates all the jobs he's given, so.
He does make that comment about hating every job he's been given. Kind of seems incompetent. Almost everything. So yeah, they help Lucy escape. She gets out. She sees the outside world for the very first time and seems a little taken aback by the immediate presence of skulls and bones sitting around in a dry wasteland.
Yeah, I don't think that outside world is as she imagined.
No, and I would say, as a person who's never been to California, This is what I imagine it looks like. This is my only frame of reference.
Yeah, that's exactly what it's like.
Good. Good to know. She does seem pretty happy to see the ocean, though. She seems taken aback by that. She's probably never seen that much water in her life. Unless you're counting the fucking projections that they put on the wall. We see a group of ruffians outside of a little town, a little western-looking town, and they approach a grave that's got some green shit in IV bags going into the ground. I have absolutely no clue what this green shit is that they're pumping into the grave. Do you have any ideas about that, what it could be?
So I'm assuming it's like nutrients or like some sort of food source, because they said they were keeping him alive to like cut something off of whatever was in the grave every year.
Yeah, sounds like the man in the grave has gotten himself into a pretty bad situation here. We're gonna find out. It was probably his own doing, not gonna lie.
Yeah, he does it for the love of the game.
Does do it for the love of the game. When he steps out of that coffin, I knew it was over for those guys. I knew they weren't gonna stand a damn chance against him.
They should have killed him when he went for the chicken.
They should. I was half expecting him to, like, put on a show and bite the chicken's head off or something.
Since we're talking about the ghoul now, I do think one of the CGI things that was a little awkward was his nose.
Really?
I feel like you could tell his nose was CGI'd off the entire time in the first three episodes.
Really? I see, I didn't think his nose was too bad looking. I didn't notice anything bad about it. There were a few CGI things that I thought were a little shaky, but I didn't notice the nose. I'll have to pay closer attention to that as we move on, because I might have just missed that.
Yeah, I mean, if you go back and look at it, I feel like you can pretty clearly see, like, the fuzzy black outline. Not, like, of his actual nose, but of how they edited the, like, skull nose gap into his face. You could see, like, the fuzzy kind of blackness of it.
Yeah.
It doesn't really look like what I imagine a sunken nose would look like. I don't know. I feel like it wouldn't just be, like, a black void.
That's true. But honestly, it's a minor gripe for me. I think that the makeup that they did, I saw something on Instagram this morning of them putting on his ghoul makeup, and they really committed to that. It looks like it was a long process, and they did pretty well.
Yeah, the makeup looked great, in my opinion.
And the ghoul gets offered to work a bounty. They try to recruit him to do a job with them, and they say, one last job, one last job. That's when he drops the line of that he does this shit for the love of the game. And then he grabs a piece of rope off the ground, a whip, something like that, immediately.
I think it was the rope that was holding him down in the thing. Because when he, like, gets it on the guy and then he pushes him into the coffin, it, like, goes with the coffin. So I think it's, like, part of the coffin's contraption that, like, kept him in there.
And he gets himself a little human shield to protect himself from the guy who's shooting garbage at him at high velocity.
Yeah, what the fuck was that weapon? When they first killed the first guy with that thing and there was, like, a baby doll leg sticking out of him.
So that is the junk jet, and that's a real weapon in Fallout 3 and Fallout 4. I think Fallout 3. It's definitely a weapon in Fallout 4, but you just pick up junk across the wasteland and use them as projectiles and ammo in this fucking garbage cannon.
Is it good in the games?
I've never used it because I think it looks kind of stupid, but it's definitely, I want to say it's decent early game shit that you can get, but yeah, it's an interesting weapon for sure. They've got some fun gimmick weapons in the Fallout universe, and I'm sure we're going to see a few more of those as the episodes go on. So he kills the men, decides that he's going to take that bounty for himself and track down the guy who supposedly escaped the Enclave, and that's the end of episode one. It was a pretty packed episode.
Moving on to episode two, we start out with a science facility and a man working with a dog that gets CX-404, I would say, like, burned into its skin. But he kind of takes the dog under his wing and protects it, you know? He does, like, some what in the facility looks like some illegal actions, hides the dog from some sort of inspections that need to be done, saves it from being incinerated because it's not up to spec on its weight at birth. But yeah.
Yeah, it looked like he forged the little document about the dog's weight, right?
Yeah, I think that's quite literally exactly what he did.
Yeah, and he builds the dog a little bed in the wall, which the dog seems very happy about that. The thing I didn't understand about what was happening with that is he keeping the dog a secret? I would imagine that they've got a pretty tight leash on everything that's happening in this facility, so I don't know how he keeps sneaking it to his room or his quarters every single night to kind of give that dog a safe place. I'm glad he's doing it, but I don't know how he's managing to pull it off.
Well, I know we did see that one scene where all the scientists were training their own personal dog, but I think every scientist has their dog. I think he just hides it probably at nighttime and morning time when they collect them and when they put them back in wherever they're supposed to actually be sleeping, probably because there's like a scanner or some sort of thing that needs to be done. But yeah.
In one of the scenes where he's taking the dog on a little walk throughout this facility, you see someone wheeling a body under a tarp past him, and it looks like there were some green feet sticking out, so that could have been a super mutant that they were experimenting on.
I thought that was a hand. I mean, not to nitpick,
but... No, it could have been. I might have misseen that, but I thought it might have been super mutant feet. Could have been a big hand, not quite sure.
Either way, it did look like a hulked out limb.
Yeah, for sure. One of his little science buddies decides to enter his quarters. Bro immediately sees the dog and decides to sound the alarm. I feel like that's an extreme reaction.
I thought he, like, saw the thing he was experimenting on first and started freaking out about that first.
That's true. So
he saw, like, the, like, pipe with, like, the blue shit in it or whatever.
Whatever he put into his head in this scene, it seems to be pretty key to the story, right?
Yeah, I mean, it was literally, like, some glowing pill that he injected into his the back of his head. I wonder, like, what that's supposed to be representative of. Is that, like, anything from the Fallout games?
I couldn't think of anything. I tried to think back to all of the Fallout games and think about, like, what possibly be in his head. Like, what did he chip himself with that could be so important that it would change the future of who controls the whole wasteland, you know? And spoiler for the games again, but a very minor spoiler. In a lot of the Fallout games, you're looking for this thing called the Gek, which is the Garden of Eden creation kit. It's this little kit that basically jumpstarts civilization again, gets green things grown again, clean water, all that shit. It could be a component of that, maybe something to do with that tangentially, but I don't know. I'm guessing that this is a completely new invention or thing for the show. It could also be like information about the Enclave that could change things.
That's what I thought it was, because at first I was like, maybe it's something that could reactivate like technology before the Fallout, or purify like some sort of thing. But then I was like, if it could purify something, he would just give it to the Enclave so they'd stop killing irradiated people and just purify them. But yeah, I don't know what it could be. I'm assuming it's gonna be like some sort of information source that like leads them to be able to take out the Enclave or challenge them in the future.
Yeah, it seems like the Enclave, they've got some resources at their back, despite the fact that they're operating. I don't know if they're even operating in secret anymore, because they're sending out like bounty hunters. So that kind of signals to me that they've got people out and about doing PR work or like contacting folks out in the wasteland to get them to do their dirty work.
Yeah, I mean, I guess they could be in secret if other people know about them. They just information leaks. But yeah, it doesn't seem like they're in secret, considering all of these factions know about the Enclave. All of these people have this bounty on this guy. Yeah, it doesn't make sense to me if they're trying to be like a shadowy organization, if they have this like huge public bounty out on this guy.
The doctor and the dog do a little escape of the facility, and they get attacked by an auto turret on their way out.
Oh my god, this was one of the gripes I texted you about last night. I thought this was actually quite literally the goofiest part of the whole thing, and maybe the worst part of all three episodes combined. I think it would have just been better if they had, like, a guy watching the perimeter and he got spooked by them and the dog, like, bit his face off or something. But no, they have a sick auto turret that catches them. And instead of them, like, going a different way or hiding or coming up with, like, a smart way to get around it, they just run across its field of view and the auto turret misses every single of like the 100 bullets it sprays at them while they're also running at the speed that I push my grandmother in her wheelchair.
Yeah, they were fucking at a snail's pace. This thing is shooting at them fast. Like, this is an automatic turret, like machine gun with targeting systems, and somehow it misses everyone. I sure hope that the Enclave has better fucking security systems and guards somewhere around there, because that thing is not doing anything to keep out intruders.
Yeah, I mean, no wonder they're not a shadowy organization anymore. Anyone could just walk in.
Yeah, and this facility that they're in, it looks like a lot of it's above ground, which is interesting. The Enclave, they're bunker folks. They like their underground facilities, so I wonder what drove them to start operating up here.
Yeah, I mean, it also looked fairly large and advanced technology-wise, so I mean, it would be interesting to see how they're upkeeping that, considering there's not many easily accessible resources in the wasteland.
Yeah, for sure. Alright, moving on to Lucy exploring the wasteland a little bit. This is when she comes across a guy in a shirt and a cloth for pants.
A loincloth. Yeah. Quite literally a loincloth, I'm pretty sure.
Yeah. Bro's trying to figure out his water filter to not a very successful degree. And Lucy gives him some water to sip on, and he just decides he's gonna chug the whole thing, which honestly, good for him. He did what he needed to do to survive there.
Yeah, he said something that I thought was kind of funny. He was like, if someone gives you some water, you drink the whole thing, even if you're not thirsty.
And then we find out that he's been shoving sand into his water filter, hoping that that would give him some water. I don't know how he's made it this far on his own.
Yeah, I don't know either. Maybe his dad just passed away recently.
Yeah, speaking of his dad passing away, his dad passed away in a little town over the hill called Philly. And this guy seems to warn Lucy that Philly's a dangerous place. Everyone he's ever known that's gone to Philly, dead. Gone. 6 feet under. Don't go to Philly. Lucy goes anyways. She goes over the hill, down to Philly. This is very much a junk town.
Yeah, it's given Mad Max.
Yeah, very much so. Given Mad Max. And she goes through the whole market. She has people trying to sell her stuff. They're all trying to get her business.
Surprised she didn't get the iguana meat.
Immediately when she declines the iguana meat and he goes in for the, you want to buy some dog meat instead? Was crazy. She gets to the heart of this little town and seems to be heavily inspired by Megaton from the games, which is this city in Fallout 3 in Wasteland of DC that is built around an unexploded or an undetonated nuclear bomb. And it seems to be really visually similar to that. So it was kind of cool to see that in live action, even though it's not the same town.
Why would they build around a bomb?
They decided that was the best place for them to set up shop, and
it's a great landmark.
Great landmark, and in Fallout 3, there's even a cult that pops up that worships this bomb, so
Oh my god.
That cult becomes a bigger thing in Fallout 4, but we're not going to get too deep into that, because I don't think any of that's going to matter for this show. Next, we see the doctor and the dog sitting near a cave. Dog trots out of the cave holding a human hand. That was certainly a shock. It kind of reminded me of Game of Thrones when Jon Snow's wolf comes back with the frozen hand beyond the wall.
Yes, actually.
That was my first thought when I saw that, was the human hand from Game of Thrones that what was that dog's name? Ghost. That Ghost comes back with. So yeah, they hear a roar come from the cave, and the doctor and the dog, they decide to book it away from this cave when they hear the roar come from inside. Smart decision, because just a few moments later, we cut to the scene of Maximus and Titus in a vertibird off on their way to do a mission. They've been tasked to go to Philly and track down the doctor.
Yeah, and this is kind of where we get our first real interaction with Titus, who's, suffice to say, a fucking asshole.
Yeah, he takes off his crotch armor and throws it at Maximus and is like, clean it. So
yeah, Maximus like asks him like a question about the armor. And Titus shuts him up by making him clean his dick plate.
I think Maximus tries to ask him something else, and Titus just completely ignores it. goes up to the cockpit of the vertibird and is like, set us down, I'm bored, I want to shoot something. So, not exactly a pillar of virtue that you would expect from an organization like the Brotherhood. I thought it was pretty interesting the way that they decided to hoist them down from the vertibird instead of just landing it.
Well, I know, like, paratroopers go down on a line from the helicopter, but I feel like logistically with the power armor, it would just make more sense to land instead of do all that. Yeah, actually, that's something I forgot about. Why the hell do they make the poor guy carry that giant sack just for... Why can't they just make the knight hold his gun? Like, I don't understand.
I don't know what they're keeping in there. Like, is that their rations for the next 2 months? Like, that is a giant-ass backpack. Maximus and Titus move on. They find the cave that the doctor and the dog just escaped from, and they find some evidence that their target was, in fact, here. And Titus, being the dickbag that he is, tells Maximus to go investigate the cave, and an irradiated bear has taken up residence in this cave. In the Fallout lore, these are called Yao Guai, and they're these hulking, massive bears. They're pretty scary. They're a pretty tough enemy in the Fallout games.
Yeah, and when Titus makes Maximus go into, like, the deeper areas of the cave to check if the bear is there, we see Maximus turn around and notice the bear is standing right behind Titus. And the bear attacks Titus and basically kills him. Not fully finishes him off, but puts him in a critical state when Titus is telling Maximus to give him a stim shot to save his life. He's being an absolute asshole about it, and Maximus kind of reaches his breaking point and just lets... He either lets Titus die or finishes him off. It's unclear. They cut away.
Yeah, what I took from that was after the whole razor blade incident that we're both in agreement, Maximus was behind that shit. I think he probably killed his knight, right? And honestly, the guy kind of deserved it. I don't think either of them are particularly good people. Titus was kind of asking for it with the whole belittling him while on death's door.
Yeah. Back when it happened, I was on the side of, well, he kind of got what he deserved, but I think later on as the show goes on, I see that Maximus isn't much better.
Yeah, especially when in episode 3 he gets assigned his squire. That we'll get to that later, but he's kind of a dick to him too. So once Lucy heads into the center of Philly and she comes upon this shop called Ma June's, I think it's Ma June's Emporium, something like that. She stops in, asks the woman who owns the place what she knows about Moldaver. And this seems to be a pretty dangerous question to ask, because Ma June shuts that shit down stat. She tells her that if she sticks around, it's going to be dangerous for her. Quit asking questions about Moldaver. Not a good idea.
Yeah, and then she kicks her out of the shop.
Yup. Kicks her out of the shop. Correct me if I'm wrong, but I think that they also give us a quick glance at the ghoul who is sitting in the town center of Philly. And
yeah, when Lucy walks into the shop, like just before she walks in, I believe they give us a quick glance at him just like sitting on, like, I want to say a porch of some sorts.
Yeah.
And then when she gets kicked out of the shop, she runs back into the scientist and his dog.
We cut over to Maximus testing out his new power armor. This might have been one of my favorite scenes in this episode. He's chucking garbage around, chucking rocks and pieces of wood around. At first, when I heard the screaming, I thought that he fucked something up and, like, crushed someone when he was throwing shit around.
Yeah, I'm not gonna lie, I thought he, like, collapsed the house on someone, and he was gonna be like, fuck.
But he goes around, and he sees a citizen in need. Someone is being attacked by a man, and Maximus decides to grab the guy by the skull and let the guy go. The man is very thankful that Maximus has helped him, and yeah, the guy walks away, and we get a pretty significant piece of information, a pretty significant piece of context for why these two were fighting. Man was fucking his chickens. Maximus saved a guy who was fucking chickens, so...
It's honestly in character for Maximus at this point.
It really is. I like how he just immediately went over there, before asking any questions, decided to take this poor guy by the skull and let the guy go without trying to be like, what's going on here? We get a name for the doctor finally. They name him as Dr. Wilzig. He enters the town, and a shootout occurs around him. This was a pretty fun scene.
Yeah, I think, honestly, I thought the ghoul's, like, weapon was really cool. His, like, pistol with, like, the exploding rounds. I thought that was really cool.
The way that he was just tearing holes through people.
I have a question. Do you know, like, the conversion rate? How much is a bottle cap representative of, I don't know, like, a U.S. dollar? Like,
yeah, I think that a bottle cap is roughly a dollar. Like, it's meant to be a fairly really? Equal conversion, I think. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
I could be wrong on that, but I'm pretty sure it's meant to be a sort of equal conversion. Lucy tries to intervene and de-escalate the situation. This was the scene that they released prior to the show coming out, where she walks out with her dart gun.
Tranquilizer.
Yeah, her tranquilizer. Yeah. She gives a whole speech about how the ghoul must be the aggressor in this situation, and that if he feels any animosity towards her, it's because he's the primary aggressor. She's just an upstanding citizen here trying to de-escalate the situation. Yeah, he is not very keen on listening to that shit. He's like, what the fuck is she on about right now?
Yeah, and then she shoots him with the tranquilizer, and he's like, this is one drop in a giant pool of drugs, which I'm assuming is in relation to the IV bag and later on the, I don't even know what you'd call it, like inhaler type thing he's using, which if I had to speculate is some sort of mix of painkillers and such that keep him from going feral.
Yeah, the ghoul seems to be less ghoulified than other mainline Fallout series ghouls. He's got something special going on with him. I don't know if this is like specific medication or irradiated shit that had turned him into a ghoul originally and he's got to keep consuming it to stay alive. Maybe that's what was in the grave in the first episode, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's probably something of that sort that he needs, because later on when he runs out of it, he starts freaking out.
Yeah, could just be a simple case of him wanting his fix, but I would imagine it goes a little bit deeper than that. So, shootout happens, Lucy de-escalates, unsuccessfully. Then Maximus shows up in his power armor, claiming to be Knight Titus. He orders the ghoul to stand down, and they brawl in the streets. This was pretty fun to watch. It was cool to see the ghoul kind of get knocked on his ass a little bit before finally outsmarting Maximus.
And then I think he messes with some systems in Maximus's suit by cutting a line near his neck, and Maximus basically goes flying out of the fight.
One of the things that I noted down here is when they're fighting and Maximus gets his foot stuck and the ghoul cuts the little line on his power armor, he makes some comments about how basic training isn't what it used to be, which kind of connects back to the first scene that we see him in when he's still a human. He mentions that he was a Marine for a number of years, so he likely got some power armor training when he was in the Marines. It was a fun little callback.
Yeah, it's probably also just a dig at Maximus for being sloppy with his power armor, considering it's the first time he's ever used it.
Yeah, it doesn't seem like Maximus has gotten any power armor training, like not even in case of emergency, here's what you do type of thing. But then again, when we see him in the classroom at the beginning, he doesn't seem to be a very good student of the Brotherhood. The shit that he's supposed to know, it kind of seems like he's neglecting to study what he needs to be studying and kind of just focusing on the whole fighting aspect of the Brotherhood without the other shit to go along with it.
Yeah, I think he said something about his whole motivation being he wanted to hurt the people that hurt him, basically.
And I'm sure we're going to get some more clarification on that of who hurt him. Could be the Enclave, could be a group of raiders, could be anyone at this point. If I had to speculate, I would say it's probably something to do with Moldaver, right? Like, they're gonna try and interconnect that a little bit.
Or maybe it's gonna be a group of vault dwellers that were Lucy's parents. Ooh, imagine.
little connection back to Lucy. That would be pretty sweet. We move on to Lucy and Wilzig making a run for the hills. We see Ma-Joon tell them to go across this little stretch of wasteland called the Shithole. Or at least that's what she refers to it as, is the Shithole, which is interesting. Now, they keep going. Wilzig has a prosthetic leg on right now, which that was gnarly watching them put on that prosthetic leg. We just need to take a moment and talk about...
Yeah, they, like, grinded his stump down and then put a, like, fake foot on the bottom of it.
Shit was nasty. There was a pool of blood down there, which, in our preview episode, I had mentioned that Fallout is a universe that doesn't shy away from violence, and Amazon is a studio with a history of not shying away from violence, so this show is pretty bloody and gory, a lot more so than I was expecting. I thought that they would kind of tone it down a little bit, being a video game adaptation, but they've really leaned into it. It's gory, it's nasty to look at. Wilzig and Lucy make a run for the hills. He's got one leg that has been replaced with a prosthetic because it got shot off. It's not a particularly good prosthetic. It looks like a big hunk of metal. Not really. Not what you would call high-end limb replacement. So they're hobbling across the wasteland together. Wilzig reveals that he just can't go on anymore. He tells Lucy that he took a cyanide pill and that the only important thing about himself is the chip that's in his head. So once he dies, he wants Lucy to saw off his head, take the head with her to Moldaver.
Yeah, I don't know why he didn't just have her, like, cut out the chip, in all honesty.
When we get into the next episode at the very beginning of Lucy's spot, it looks like there might be some safety measures in place to prevent anyone from taking the chip out of the head.
That is true. She, like, touches it and it electrocutes her.
It also looked like the process to get it in was fucking crazy. So it's definitely got some safeguards to prevent anyone without the correct access from taking that stuff out. All right, I think that's the end of episode 2. Moving on to episode 3. Now we open up with, back in pre-war times, we see Cooper Howard starring in a Western film. It's kind of funny to me that he's starring in a Western film, given the fact that he takes on this persona of, like, a cowboy ghoul in the aftermath of the apocalypse. It's interesting that he kind of gives off this air of being, like, a pacifist. He was like, I don't really want my guy to execute the criminal. I just want him to arrest him. He's the sheriff. Gotta follow the legal paths.
Yeah, clearly some crazy stuff has gone down between then and now, which we're gonna keep getting tidbits of and piecing together. But I think his past is really interesting compared to his present.
So we move on to present day? I don't, what would we call that? We move on to what's currently happening in the universe, and we see Lucy carrying Wilzig's severed head across the wasteland while Maybe by the Ink Spots plays. She then sits down, shoves a tracker up Wilzig's nose as a precaution. This is definitely going to come in handy later, right? The whole tracker up the nose nonsense?
Yeah, I'm assuming, because later in the episode, as we're going to discuss, some other people get their hands on the head and she's not with them.
We cut back to Maximus repairing his armor. He chains it up to some sort of rig to try and fix it up a little bit, but one of the pieces of his armor is pretty fucked up. He can't get it repaired, so he goes into town to haggle with a merchant.
And then he sells a tooth to make up the difference in price for the repair fee.
And the repair seems pretty immediate and not very costly. He definitely got swindled a little bit on that one. Bro should have negotiated a little bit harder.
Yeah, I mean, didn't seem like the person really cared to help him out, though, so.
Now, I'm wondering, do the Brotherhood of Steel members not get pay? Like, are they not given a little stipend for being a part of this military organization? Because Maximus seems pretty broke. He's got 4 bottle caps to his name that are sitting in his shoe.
Yeah, I mean, I'm assuming their form of pay is, like, housing and food and such. Like, considering the state of the wasteland, their situation is better than most scavengers and what you'd call wasteland people.
Yeah, absolutely. Maximus gets back to his armor after procuring the repaired piece, and there's some scavengers at his armor. The second I saw him leave that armor, I knew that this was going to happen. I I saw that coming from a mile away.
Yeah, I don't know what he was thinking leaving the armor. That shit was gonna get fucked with immediately. I mean, that's a crazy piece of technology, and we know people are gonna be all over that. Also, he didn't bring any weapons with him either. And also, when he stole the armor from Titus, or after he killed Titus and stole the armor, he didn't, like, go back into the cave and get the giant gun. He didn't get his pistol that he used to kill the bear with. He didn't get any of... He didn't get his giant squire pack with all the survival gear and shit that he... Like, I don't understand. Maximus is just a idiot.
Yeah, he seems to have no common sense. Seems to be really arrogant about his abilities, about his capabilities. Like, when he gets back up and tries to go back over there with a tire iron and a toilet seat to fight these four massive dudes, I was like, oh my god, bro, you are such an idiot. Why are you going over there? And he gets the shit beat out of him again. If he wasn't pinned up against the power armor and didn't have access to the one hand, he would have been dead.
I thought a weird part about that scene though was when he killed that guy with the power armor and the other guy like freaked out and ran away. I was like, there's no way this guy is that freaked out about that. I mean, like, yeah, it's a weird way to see someone die, but let's not pretend like this guy probably hasn't seen like 1,000 people die. I mean, didn't they all just live through that giant shootout where they watched the ghoul blow chunks off of people, like 30 people?
I feel like in the time that we've spent in Philly, we've seen so many people die. Not only in the shootout, but in the very beginning when Lucy enters the town, some guy and another guy bump into each other, and the other guy smacks him to the ground and starts beating on him with a hammer. Like, this is a violent place with no rules.
Yeah, in all honesty, I felt like that one situation was kind of just lazy writing, because, I mean, what did we get out of it, you know? Like, he gets back, and he gets his ass beat, and that's it.
It seems to be a trend for Maximus just to get the shit beat out of him in every situation.
Yeah, I mean, I feel if they wanted to, like, do something where, like, they ended up breaking something on his suit, like, I feel they could have had them break his comms that way instead of him just breaking it himself, you know? I just feel like there's no point for that scene.
Speaking of the radio, after he deals with the scavengers who try to get his power armor, he gets a call on the radio asking him why they haven't checked in yet. More specifically, asking Knight Titus why he hasn't checked in yet. So Maximus pretends to be Knight Titus and declares that Maximus is dead. They say, oh, we can send you a new squire. No worries, man. We got you. We've got plenty of these fuckers laying around over here. We'll just airdrop you in another one. He tries his best to avoid that because he wants to do a whole lone wolf thing as to not reveal his cover. Yeah, it turns out that the squire that they airdrop in for him is none other than his old bully, Thaddeus.
Before we get on with Thaddeus and his squire, I think this is one part in the series that I got a little confused with. Like, what is Maximus's plan, you know? I think he literally could have just told the truth and been like, Titus died in battle and I'm the last remnant, I need rescue or whatever, I didn't know how to use the radio because I have no training in the armor. He's cut off his only source of making it back into the Brotherhood now, because I guess if he, like, I mean, we heard what he said earlier. He was like, I'm gonna do the contract and get the guy and they're gonna accept me for that. But I feel like now that he's lied about being Titus, they're gonna be like, dude, what? No.
I think that this once again points to him being a fucking idiot, because his plan right now is go capture the target, bring it back to the Brotherhood, and hope that they are so thrilled with the fact that he got the target that they're going to forgive the fact that he pretended to be Titus and promote him to be a knight, which is such a long shot, because even if he does bring back the target, why would they forgive him for everything he's done? Why would they trust him again? They're never going to send him on a mission when he just lied about everything, even if he got the mission done.
No, yeah, even though this is being hyped up to be one of the most important things that anyone could do for any group, even if he completes it, he's going to get back and they're just going to be like, well, this is his second time being an absolute liability to us. He said he didn't betray his other friend, but then he betrayed Titus or pretended to be Titus. Like, we can't trust this guy. I don't know what they're going to do with that moving forward.
I think that eventually he's going to have a break from the Brotherhood. That's kind of my theory. I think that eventually we're going to see the Ghoul, we're going to see Lucy, and we're going to see Maximus working together. I think that Moldaver and the Enclave are going to be this greater threat that they all have to sort of come together to face, and that might force Maximus to really question whether or not he wants to be a part of the Brotherhood. He might have to go through some real character development and not just be a little dipshit like he's been for the first three episodes.
Yeah, I'm not gonna lie, so far Maximus might be my least favorite character.
The Brotherhood of Steel in the past two Fallout games, minor spoiler by the way, are all very idealistic, very committed to the cause, and in some ways a lot of their members are committed to helping people in the wasteland and in the outside world, which was not the original Brotherhood doctrine. The original Brotherhood doctrine was avoid helping people, just get the technology and get out, but it seems like they've kind of gone back to that from what the games have done recently, where they've made the Brotherhood this generic good guy faction. They've gone back to the roots of Fallout 1 and 2, where these folks are basically cultists in this military order. Speaking of the way that the Brotherhood is organized, they talk about there being high clerics in the Commonwealth. Traditionally, the leaders of the Brotherhood have been referred to as elders, so I don't know if they've just made a substitution and decided to call them clerics instead of elders to go with that sort of religious culty vibe, or maybe they've decided that in the 10 years that have passed since Fallout 4, that the Brotherhood has undergone a restructuring, where instead of having elders at the head, there's maybe a council of clerics, something like that. So I'm interested to learn more about what the structure of the world is looking like right now.
Yeah, me too, because I feel like we've done a lot of character deep dives in the first three episodes, kind of figuring out who these people are, how they act, but I feel like we haven't really explored a lot of the world and who runs it.
I'm going to save some of my feedback on that for our wrap-up at the end of this podcast, which is coming up soon, but I have some gripes about what they've done with the lore and the world building. Not necessarily gripes, just things that I'm a little bit confused about, that they might answer these questions by the time we get to the next few episodes, but yeah, I've definitely got a few things that I'm not quite happy about in these episodes. But moving on, we see Lucy come upon this flooded city, which I think is just more of LA ruined. I don't think that she's gotten far enough to really get outside of that general area yet. She sees this flooded, ruined city, and she gets attacked by a creature called a gulper, which is an axolotl with a bunch of human fingers in its mouth. This thing is freaky looking. Fucking scary ass monster.
Yeah, I think they did a good job with the CGI on the monsters. The bear looked good, the gulper looked good, and the water effects looked good, too.
I agree with you. Now, the gulper ends up getting the head from Lucy, and swallows Wilzig's head, and Lucy's like, shit, what are we gonna do now? But she doesn't really have time to come up with a plan, because immediately the ghoul ambushes her. The ghoul is now accompanied by Wilzig's dog. He nursed it back to health, which shows a little bit of compassion from him. We see him break the tough guy exterior for a minute when he nurses the dog back to health and brings it with him. He very much tries to give off the air that he doesn't care about anything, but I think that deep down he's got a soft heart in there somewhere.
I thought he just nursed it back to health to track down Wilzig's head from the scent.
It very well could be. But I'd like to think that some of what he had in the pre-war times of his humanity is still in there somewhere. And I hope we get to see that a little bit more. Not that I don't like his character as this cold, ruthless mercenary, but I'd like to see him be a little bit more three-dimensional. Maximus and Thaddeus track the ghoul, and they find Wilzig's corpse, and the two of them sort of are debating over what the hell is happening and who cut off his head, and Maximus is like, oh, it had to be the ghoul. There's no way that vault dweller did this, even though it was Lucy who decapitated Wilzig.
Yeah, and I think we didn't mention it, but earlier when Maximus gets his squire and meets him, he sees it's Thaddeus, and he basically just immediately repeats like the cycle of fucking with your squire that pushed him to the edge with Thaddeus, which is another point that really made me dislike Maximus. I know that Thaddeus was not good to Maximus, but at this point, Thaddeus doesn't know it's Maximus. He's treating him basically like a godly figure before him. And I don't know. I think this just is another point that proves Maximus is just an asshole shithead in my eyes so far.
Yeah, the scene where he tells Thaddeus to climb up a dead tree to look for apples because he's hungry, I was like, come on, man. There's no... How does Thaddeus even keep a straight face while he's asked to do this shit? Like, he's being given the most asinine tasks possible. The ghoul has Lucy strung up by the river and starts using her as bait for the gulper. Lucy's like, why are you torturing me? What did I do to you? And the ghoul delivers this whole speech about how there used to be studies back in the old days before the bombs, and that a study came out saying that torture isn't effective, and tells her, I'm not torturing you, I'm using you as bait. Not that Lucy can really tell the difference at this point, because she's getting abused pretty hard here in this scene.
Yeah, and then they finally get the gulper, and Lucy defends herself by grabbing one of the ghoul's bags and smacking the gulper in the face till it leaves her alone. Ghoul runs over to the bag and sees that his medicine that's been keeping him going, or so I think, is broken, and he starts freaking out at Lucy. He says something about how gulpers digest slowly and takes Lucy on a journey somewhere else.
Yeah, I'm gonna be interested to see. The ghoul doesn't have any more of this stuff as far as we know, so I wonder if his condition is gonna start to deteriorate and Lucy's gonna have to take the lead, or maybe Lucy's gonna leave him. I don't know what's gonna happen with that, but ghoul is definitely gonna be struggling in the next episode, without a doubt.
Yeah, he seems like a major, major character though, so I know he's definitely not done for because of this.
For sure. We cut back to the vault where they're having a vault-wide meeting, and there's not a lot of people left in this vault. There's seriously, like, their population is depleted. They're kind of fucked here. Even more fucked than they would have been if it was just the raiders that got to them, because we have someone who I'm assuming is the vault mechanic coming onto the scene to say that the water chip is broken and they've only got 2 months left of clean water.
Yeah, and then they have a disagreement about what they should be doing with their imprisoned raiders, with some people believing they should kill them off or let them die, while others think they should try a extended rehabilitation process.
We get to visit these imprisoned raiders, which this was another little gripe that I had about this episode, was I thought that the raiders all left with when the father was taken prisoner by Lee Moldaver, something like that. When the father was taken prisoner by Moldaver, I thought that the raiders would have just left with her, but apparently they captured some of them, which I don't really know how that happened. It seemed like the...
Yeah, it didn't make sense to me either. I thought they would have all killed each other in battle, escape. I don't know in what way they would have been able to... I mean, it looked like the Vault Dwellers were losing the fight, too. So,
yeah,
I don't know how they would have subdued them. I guess maybe they were the ones that Lucy tranquilized? I don't know.
Yeah, definitely could have been, because it didn't seem like, other than Lucy tranquilizing these folks, it didn't seem like they had a whole lot of fight in them. They didn't seem to be fighting back a whole lot. They were just kind of doing the bare minimum. Except for the lady who got the fork in the eye. She had her machine gun, and she was going ham during the fight scene in that first episode. To go back to the water chip for 1 minute, I'm going to give another game spoiler warning. The water chip being broken is a direct reference to the first Fallout game. Your character is sent out to the wasteland to get a new water chip for their vault by the Overseer, and that's how the plot of Fallout 1 kicks off, is you get sent out to the wasteland to repair the water chip. So I don't know if anything is going to come of this other than it being just a fun little reference to the first Fallout game, or if it's going to be a pretty major plot point.
The next scene we come upon in the show is when Thaddeus and Maximus find the gulper and fight it, where Thaddeus is almost eaten by the gulper, but Maximus manages to pull Thaddeus out of the gulper's mouth while also pulling the stomach of the gulper out of its mouth and tearing it open while killing the gulper at the same time. And they find Wilzig's head, and Thaddeus is grateful to Maximus for saving his life.
I thought that this was going to be a scene where Maximus might reveal who he actually is to Thaddeus, because they seem to have this bonding moment earlier in the episode where Thaddeus seems to kind of open up to Maximus about how it wasn't personal what he was doing to Maximus. It was very much just kind of a hazing thing. That doesn't make it any better. Let me clarify that it was just hazing, but it seems to soften Maximus up to Thaddeus a little bit. And then with them fighting side by side and Maximus saving him, I'm waiting for that final reveal where he finally finds out that Titus is dead and it's Maximus in the armor. It should be a pretty big moment, and I'm surprised it hasn't happened yet, to be honest, because I know Maximus isn't sleeping in that armor. He's gotta be going to sleep.
I mean, he must be, right?
I guess so, but I feel like that's...
He's either sleeping in the armor or they've only been together for a day.
That is true. When did he airdrop in? Was it that same day that...
It was not long before they run into the gulper, I'm pretty sure, because he airdrops in, and I think it's literally, like, right before they find the body of Dr. Wilzig.
So let's give them the benefit of the doubt and say that they've only been together for a day, and that's why Maximus hasn't come out of the armor, because when Thaddeus was trying to refill his water supply and opens up the back of his helmet, he was freaking out. He was not ready for that to happen. So yeah, now Maximus and Thaddeus have possession of the head and by extension the chip inside of it. So they're the ones in control in this game of, what was it? Game of Pass the Pickle? What is it? What is that fucking called? Pickle in the Middle? What is that shit?
Hot potato?
Yeah, this game of hot potato that they're playing with the head.
What the heck are you trying to say, dude?
I don't know. Holy shit.
Maybe you're too irradiated.
So this game of back and forth that they're playing with the head, they've got possession now. They've also got the dog with them. I don't know why the dog decided not to follow the ghoul and Lucy when they... Sort of.
Well, because like I said before, the dog was just following the scent of Wilzig, and now that they have the head, they've got the dog. Remember the dog stayed at the like dock after the ghoul took Lucy to get his medicine or drugs or whatever.
That's very true. I know that the dog is chipped too. I wonder if more than maybe just him following.
Wait, I thought that he didn't get the chip in the dog. Wasn't that the whole thing?
I thought that the dog was chipped as well.
He saved the dog from getting chipped? Or do you mean chipped with, like, the special chip that he made?
I think that the dog might have the special chip in it, too.
I don't think it does.
Because he...
But maybe that's a scene I missed.
In episode 2 at the beginning, when he's with the dog and they've got the whole introduction to Wilzig, and I'm gonna call the dog Dog Meat from now on, because that's definitely gonna be its name. In every single Fallout game, the dog, which looks exactly like this dog that is with the player character, the dogs are named Dog Meat, the dog companions. So I'm just gonna call the dog Dog Meat from now on. Yeah. So Wilzig and Dog Meat leave, and I was pretty sure that I saw Wilzig put the same long chip tube into him, but I could be wrong on that. Maybe Dog Meat...
Are you sure you're not remembering the stim shot the ghoul used on the dog?
It could be. I need to go and do another watch of these episodes before we do our next
podcast. I don't remember that chip, but I mean, it's completely possible. I did make ramen while watching the episodes.
It could be. So, on to the final scene of episode 3. In the pre-war times, we see Cooper Howard and his wife talking about doing this commercial. Cooper Howard comes out in a vault suit and does an advertisement for Vault Tech. Tells them that they're doing God's work and that any true red-blooded American is on their side.
Yep, and then while he's doing like the photo shoot for the ad, he suggests a thumbs up while wearing the vault suit that we see like the Vault Tech mascot does, and I think that's what the guy was referencing when he was at the birthday party and he asked him to do the thumbs up.
Yeah, so it looks like the Vault Boy, the little mascot for Vault Tech, is, or at the very least, the gesture he's doing is based on the one and only Cooper Howard. So I'm sure we're going to get into his falling out with Vault Tech, because by the time the bombs drop, he seems to have a pretty hateful relationship with Vault Tech. He wants nothing to do with them anymore. He doesn't want to be remembered for the thumbs up. So it'll be interesting to see how that plays out. Let's get into any final closing thoughts and feelings on the episode. Chase, we're three episodes into the season. How are we feeling so far about this show?
I think so far it's definitely like a mid 8 out of 10, you know, like 8 point something out of 10. And that's not bad for sure. I think it's so far really good. It's definitely ramping up near the end. It's getting more and more interesting, drawing me in. So I don't expect the show to be a disappointment by the end. From what we've seen.
Yeah, I'm with you. I think that placing it somewhere in the 8, 8.5 range is probably where I would put it too in these first three episodes. I will say I enjoyed episodes 1 and 2 significantly more than episode 3. I thought episode 3 was kind of on the slow side and not a lot happened for the plot, but I think that they were doing a lot of important setup for the rest of the season that is going to take us to a place where we can really get going in the next few episodes.
Really? I'm not going to lie. I thought episode 2 was the least enjoyable out of the three. I thought episode 3 was actually my favorite because I think they did a lot of character background and character building in episode 3. I felt like I really got to learn a lot about who we are watching in that episode.
We did get to spend a lot more time with them as people. There was a lot of fighting going on in that episode that kind of gave it some bloat.
Yeah, I mean, the fights were definitely really enjoyable, but I do feel like we did spend a lot of time on it when it could have been cut down. Especially since episode 2, was that the long one? The like really, really long one? No, that was episode 1.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was episode 1 that was a little bit longer.
I just felt like episode 2 was like mostly the fight, and I felt like I didn't really get to know anyone, you know? It's the beginning of the series. I'm trying to figure out who our protagonists are, what drives their actions, you know, and I felt like episode 3 gave us a lot of information on that.
I agree. And earlier in the podcast, I mentioned that there were a few gripes I had with the way that they're doing the lore and the world building. I've got one burning question for this series. Where the fuck is the New California Republic? They should.
Okay, I was going to say the same thing because I remember you telling me about how they're a really big part of the Fallout like universe. And I think that's like basically like what Moldover is a part of, right? Or something of that sort. And I feel like we haven't even heard a peep about them, which is crazy considering they're supposed to be like the largest organized group of any surviving like city in Fallout.
Yeah, it's especially concerning that we haven't seen anything from them yet. Not concerning for the series, but concerning for the state of the New California Republic, because these vaults that Lucy comes out of are in LA, and one of the major cities or settlements that is a part of the NCR is called the Angel's Boneyard, or just more simply the Boneyard. And it's the collective name given to the ruins of the city of Los Angeles and the like numerous settlements that sort of popped up in there. And the whole like urban area, when the New California Republic is formed, the Boneyard becomes the state of Los Angeles, like one of the major states in the NCR. So they've got some explaining to do for why we haven't seen any of that, because I feel like Philly should be core NCR territory, you know? Like, if it's a city that, or not a city, if it's a town that exists in the ruins of LA, that shit should be under lockdown by the NCR. They should have police there, they should have infrastructure. I don't know where the NCR
are. Are we sure they're in LA? I mean, I believe you. I just didn't know that's actually where they are.
Yeah, so that's the Boneyard is one of their major cities, and it's definitely in the ruins of Los Angeles. It's not their capital, and so maybe it's possible that the Boneyard could have collapsed. Maybe the NCR has fallen on hard times, and a few settlements have collapsed. They've lost some ground. the last time we see the NCR, they're not doing super hot internally. They've got some political struggles going on. They're at war, and they've got political factions vying for power that sort of threaten to tear the NCR apart. We don't get any resolution to that in the last game that we see them in, so it's possible that the NCR could have collapsed in the last 10 years. I hope not, especially since in the trailers and promotional videos we see the NCR flag in one of the vaults. We haven't seen that in the show yet, so it's got to be a vault that we haven't seen yet. But yeah, we see the NCR flag there, and we also see a sign saying welcome to Sate. We also see a sign saying something about Shady Sands Public Library, and Shady Sands is the capital of the NCR. So I think we're going to see them at one point. I like your theory that Moldaver is somehow involved with the NCR. I think that right now that's probably the best guess as to who she's involved with.
Yeah, it just makes sense to me considering she's not involved with the Enclave clearly, right? And not the Brotherhood also. I think one thing, though, not we shouldn't get too ahead of ourselves on is, I mean, LA is pretty big. California is pretty big. She's only been on the surface for, like, a day and a half now, on foot, too. So it's entirely possible she just hasn't run into the settlements yet.
That's very true. She could have just been in parts of the ruins of Los Angeles that are maybe a little bit more on the wild wasteland side. They're not as closely under NCR control. Yeah, we don't really know the state of anything in this world. It takes place 10 years after the last Fallout game, so things could be really different. We don't know if the Brotherhood might have come into conflict with the NCR and that's why they've lost control of the region. Yeah, we'll just, that's something to keep an eye on as we continue.
All right, before we go into our outro, do we have any other closing thoughts or theories?
I think that as for theory crafting and speculation on the future of the show, that's about all I've got. How about you?
No, the biggest theory I had was the Moldaver stuff. But other than that, I think the other theory I mentioned before was maybe one of Lucy's parents being a non-vault dweller that somehow got into the vault, and that's how they know about Moldaver, and that's how Moldaver knows about her mother. But I don't know, other than that.
Yeah, I think that that's a pretty good theory. Moldaver definitely seems to know Lucy's mother somehow. At first, when she made that comment, I sort of thought it was an allusion to when the father says, "You look so much like your mother." I thought maybe she was just trying to fuck with Lucy, but the more I think about it, I think that it's definitely alluding to her knowing Lucy's mother personally.
For feedback, there are a few ways to contact us. First being email with fallout@thelorehounds.com. We also have a channel set up for Radioactive Ramblings within the Lorehounds Discord server where you can send us a message or chat about the show. You can also contact us by using the contact form or leaving us a voicemail by using thelorehounds.com. And please leave us a rating on Apple Podcasts. It helps other listeners like you find us.
To add one more thing to that, we are newly on X, the app formerly known as Twitter. You can find us at Radioactive141. We'll be giving some updates on the podcast there, interacting with the community a little bit, so give us a follow there. Now, some final notes before we close the show for today. We are affiliated with the Lorehounds Barovian Podcasting Network, and as Chase mentioned before, they've got a Discord server set up for all of their various communities. It's a pretty fun and welcoming community with channels set up for all different shows and projects. It's a great place to meet and converse with others who have similar interests. There will be links to the Discord in our show notes, and we are open to everyone. We have additional channels just for subscribers to the Lorehounds Patreon, but most channels are open to anyone. We are affiliated with a few different podcasts that are part of the Lorehounds network, that being Rings and Rituals, a show where Marilyn R. Pukila and Dr. Sarah Brown of Signum University analyze season one of the Rings of Power through the lens of ritual. Over at Woolshift Dust, Alicia is covering Beacon 23, season 2 of that, and she has an interview coming up with author Hugh Howie, who is the author of Beacon 23, Silo, and a few other really prolific sci-fi books, so that should be an exciting thing to look forward to. Over at Properly Howard Movie Review, two old friends, Anthony and Steve, an academic and a stand-up comic, review films on a scale of better or worse than a Ron Howard film. Their new season theme is Felonies and Fugazis, where they review some movies that have to do with crime. Be sure to check out the preview pod for this season where Anthony and Steve draft their movies. There's also a joint Lorehounds and Properly Howard movie review production called The Severance Podcast, where Anthony and Steve have recapped every episode of season 1 of Severance, and that feed is live and complete right now. They are currently going to be on hiatus until season 2 comes. They're waiting on news for that right now, but once season 2 comes out, John and David from the Lorehounds, accompanied by Anthony and Steve from Properly Howard, are going to be doing weekly episode-by-episode coverage of the Apple series Severance. Over at our parent podcast, The Lorehounds, they are currently covering Shogun on FX and Hulu. They're going to be doing a season wrap-up with feedback once the season is over, and that'll include David, John, and Alicia from Woolshift Dust, with a special guest, Nathan Ledbetter, a PhD candidate and member of the East Asian Studies Department over at Princeton. He's a new addition to the community and a welcome one. He's got a lot of great insight into this show over on the Discord server. And that concludes our podcast for today. Thank you all so much for listening, and we look forward to the next episode.
A new Star Wars journey begins in the place all good journeys begin. At, well, the beginning. This Star Wars Day, I'm excited to introduce the new Star Wars Canon Timeline podcast, where we will piece together the complete story of that galaxy far, far away, in timeline order, from the dawn of the Jedi through the great unknown following the sequel trilogy. This is a podcast for both Star Wars superfans and complete newbies. Listen to the short intro episode now to hear how it works and what to expect over the coming weeks as we set the stage for the new television series The Acolyte, which we will be covering with weekly breakdowns. Subscribe to the Star Wars Canon Timeline podcast wherever you listen to take part in one of the most epic and expansive stories ever told, following all the twists and turns from start to finish. May the 4th be with you all month and beyond.